Hello and welcome to Leading Minds, voices from the College of Medicine, Nursing and Health Sciences at NUI Galway. Research at the college strives to improve healthcare both regionally, nationally and internationally. And that's why today we're delighted to be joined by Professor Moira Connolly. She is an expert in pandemic preparedness and she spent the best part of two decades working with the WHO in looking at emerging infectious diseases. She also sits on a number of advisory groups helping governments make decisions, particularly with response with regards to COVID-19. Professor, you're very welcome. Perhaps you might start off by telling me a little bit about how you got interested in emerging infectious diseases.
Hi, Jonathan, and thank you for the opportunity to be part of this important podcast series. And you can call me Maura. So my initial introduction to population health was really during my time in NUI Galway, then called UCG, where I worked in a government hospital in Kenya as part of the voluntary services abroad group. And at that point, I saw the importance of population health, how while within medical school, we focus on clinical care and individual patients, I saw the benefit and the importance of healthcare from a population perspective. I then subsequently worked in a number of clinical jobs, including one in Baghdad in Iraq. And again, I was there at the time of the 1990 Kurdish movement of Kurdish refugees into Baghdad. And again, I saw the healthcare needs of refugee populations. I then did a master's in public health in UCD, and from that trained in public health medicine in the UK. And as part of that work, I worked on tuberculosis programs in Siberia. And then I joined WHO in Geneva in 1995, working on TB in refugees, and then from there into refugee health. So I worked on a number of emerging disease outbreaks. So we would have dealt with diseases like cholera, measles, Shigella, and some, you know, scarier diseases like dengue and Ebola. So that's essentially a roundabout way in how I managed to get working in the area of emerging infectious diseases. I coordinated a project here at NUI Galway in 2015 on pandemic preparedness, and we looked at three core areas of surveillance, communications and governance. And I'm now coordinating a second phase project in follow-up to that initial phase one.
That must have been quite a scary thing to be a young researcher going to places of great conflict, where, as you say, there are these emerging infectious diseases. Can you talk to me a little bit about what that looked like and how you felt working in those conditions?
Well, there were challenging conditions. I suppose East Timor was one emergency response that I was part of that was particularly I suppose concerning. I was doing a mosquito survey for WHO, and we were held, myself and two Colombian logisticians were held at gunpoint by the Indonesian army because we were trying to hang the mosquito traps in an area where the army were present. They were in retreat from East Timor. And then there was a second episode that evening where we got held up a second time. And so there were a number of incidences that would have, I suppose, been a concern in terms of security. I was in Kabul in...
You say that sort of in a throwaway fashion. A slight concern, but you're being held at gunpoint. It's probably not something most scientists could say.
Well, I suppose it's the nature of work in conflict zones, and no more than war journalists, you get used to it and you know what to do. And you're also trained. Part of our UN training was to be aware of security threats and what to do if you were to get taken hostage or you'd be in a conflict situation. So I had a number of those incidences. And, you know, the more experience you have of them, the better able you are to deal with them. In Kabul in February 2002, I was part of the first UN mission after the Taliban were defeated, and it's obviously very topical at the moment and difficult to see a country 20 years later having to go back to that level of conflict and disruption. But there have been many incidences. In addition to that sense of risk and threat, the potential to do good work is phenomenal, and the honour of working with some very committed international public health physicians has been very rewarding in terms of using your skills and the knowledge that I gained in UCG to try and improve health outcomes among refugee populations.
I presume it's sort of a perfect storm, a refugee crisis when it comes to infectious diseases. You have large numbers of displaced people. They are not often in a place where they can get good access to sanitation, clean water, and so on. And it's probably one of the worst places to be in terms of infectious diseases. Would that be right?
Yes, absolutely. And we've looked at mortality rates among refugee populations, and they are at the highest risk of increased mortality, particularly children under five. And they die from diseases like malaria, pneumonia, diarrheal disease, common diseases that are relatively easy to manage. So our role within WHO was to set up healthcare systems along with the non-governmental organizations and to set up surveillance systems to detect any outbreaks. So my main role in those camps was to ensure the population were protected from emerging infectious diseases, from epidemic threats that can cause very high death rates in camp situations.
What did that look like in terms of setting up this surveillance? Was it a contract, a basic sort of contact and trace system, or how do you monitor a population that is moving and often doesn't have a great identification or an address that you can find them in?
Well, we would work very closely with UNHCR, who were in charge of camp coordination. So I'll give you an example of Zatar refugee camp, which is in Jordan. And so there were over 100,000 Syrian refugees there. This was following the conflict that occurred 10 years ago now. So our role would be to work with the UNHCR, UNICEF and the NGOs to agree a specified list of diseases that we wanted to monitor. And we would then work with the health facilities, both the outpatient departments and the hospital, to ensure that we'd have a very good record of the diseases that the refugee population were presenting with. And we would have an early warning system. So, for example, if there was an increase in the number of cases of any case of measles, we would know that that is a potential outbreak and we would follow up on that. Equally, a disease like cholera or other diarrheal diseases. And in areas where malaria was endemic, we would also monitor the malaria incidents. So that we would have a stockpile of resources like we've done here in Ireland for the COVID-19 response. We'd have a stockpile of PPE, of diagnostic tests, of therapeutic interventions, depending on the disease. So for cholera, it would be intravenous fluids. For other, for pneumonia and diarrheal disease, antibiotics would be held in reserve. So part of our initial work in WHO at any crisis, at the outset of any crisis, my team in Geneva would have done a risk assessment of what are the major diseases that pose a threat to this population who have just been displaced. And then we would field teams to go to that, the epicenter of that crisis, to work in the refugee camps with the displaced persons. And our role was almost like a de facto Department of Health. In many of these situations, the country has been racked by conflict and war. In many cases, has gone on for months or years before the actual population displacement. So we have to react very quickly. We have to be able to get access to real-time information. And we've got to ensure that we have the stockpiles of the medical countermeasures that need to be used in the event of an epidemic.
I suppose all of this sets you up quite nicely to work in the area of pandemic preparedness. This is an area you were working on well before COVID came along. Can you tell me about your work in that area?
Well, my work in that area started really, I suppose, SARS in 2003 was the one wake-up call that hit the world. Myself, my team and the Emerging Infectious Disease Department, we would have been working on emerging threats across countries globally. But in most cases, they occurred in low and middle income countries and didn't really impact on Europe. But 2003 outbreak of SARS, which originated in Guangdong province in China, showed that we were quite vulnerable to a pandemic of a respiratory pathogen. At that time, Gro Harlem Brundtland, the former Prime Minister of Norway, she was the Director General of WHO, and it was a really well-managed response. There was one factor with this coronavirus, SARS-CoV-1, that allowed us to control it to only 8,000 cases and 800 deaths. And that was the specific factor of SARS-1. You had to be sick for a week with symptoms before you transmitted it on to another person. The big challenge that we have with SARS-2 is that you can actually transmit this virus without being sick or before you become sick. So for SARS-1, we managed to implement the core public health interventions, what was done in the Middle Ages for plague. So the word quarantine comes from 40 days. So ships arriving into the port of Venice, if there was any report of fever or illness on board the ship, they had to remain in the port away from land for 40 days. So in SARS-1, we implemented these medieval measures to control the disease, rapid isolation, rapid identification of cases, and quarantine of contacts. And for SARS-2, unfortunately, this virus has evolved to have that ability to transmit without symptoms. And that's why it has got such a foothold globally and why it has caused such disruption and devastation over the past 18 months.
The thing about SARS that people forget is how deadly that virus was. And this SARS-2, COVID-19, is not as deadly, but far more transmissible. And of course, the real worry is that you might get a mixture of those two, which is theoretically possible, right? Is that something that you feel is inevitable in the future?
Well, you're absolutely right. With SARS-2, the mortality rate is about 1%. With SARS-1, it was 10%. With MERS, another coronavirus very related to SARS-1 and 2, the mortality rate with that is 30%. The characteristics of SARS-1 and MERS is that they do not have efficient human-to-human transmission. So yes, there is a theoretical possibility that there is another coronavirus out there. And remember, there are about 1,000 coronaviruses circulating among wildlife. We know of 7 that can infect man, but it is very likely that there are others out there that could potentially infect man. And while, you know, I'm very cognizant of the fact that we are now coming out of this pandemic and we're not through it yet, primarily due to the challenges of mutation and vaccine escape among Delta variants and now the latest Mu variant. But the reality is that the biological world continues to threaten human populations. CDC have estimated that there are almost 500,000 viruses out there that could potentially affect man. We know of 250 that have spilled over from animal populations into humans. And what we saw happening in November, December 2019 in Wuhan was a single spillover event that has led to massive transmission across the world. And the reality is there are many other pathogens that could potentially pose a threat to human populations in the future.
I mean, given the nature of the threat, it's surprising how it seemed to some of us that, depending on the country you were in, of course, but we seemed very ill prepared to handle something like COVID-19. And I suppose that's why your work is so important. Can you tell me about your work at NUI Galway and the Pandem2 project?
Okay, so Pandem2 is a security research project funded by the European Commission. Phase 1, we looked at the areas of surveillance, communications and governance. And we looked at how well prepared Europe was for the next pandemic. And I suppose to put it into context, we had the SARS-1 outbreak, which really affected about 10 or 15 countries, did not really have an impact on Europe to any significant level. We then had H1N1 in 2009, which was a pandemic of influenza, but it was actually a very mild clinical condition, partly because older age groups had previous immunological memory of this H1N1 strain. So I think a lot of governments kind of felt, well, you know, we're kind of, you know, WHO may be over-egging it, increasing, you know, overemphasizing the potential threat. And, you know, we are dealing with many other threats that face governments, be it the financial crisis, be it climate change. So And I think public health medicine as well in many countries is an area that the investment wasn't there to the level that was needed. And what we've seen from COVID-19 is the countries who had previous experience of SARS and MERS and bird flu or H5N1, they had well-funded, well-established public health systems linked to efficient laboratory capacity and contact tracing that were able to rapidly scale up at the outset of the pandemic. You had countries like South Korea, who really have done an incredibly successful response to COVID-19. Japan had a very efficient, well-run contact tracing system, which followed the virus through karaoke clubs at the outset and were very provided hugely valuable information on the epidemiology of this new virus. You had Taiwan, a country which rapidly scaled up mask production to almost 20 million within the first 6 to 8 weeks of the pandemic. So I think, you know, within Europe, there was a complacency and there was a possibly a lack of funding in public health structures. And I think the key issue now is to ensure that the investment that has been made over the past 18 months, that we don't lose that, that we maintain a backup function, both in our public health systems, our public health departments, our laboratory capacity within our hospitals and our GPs, so that this can be scaled up rapidly in the event of another pandemic.
Yeah, I have the feeling that this is one scar that the global population won't forget. And hopefully that funding will flow to where it needs to prepare us for the next pandemic. What exactly is the nature of your research, though, Moira? Do you look at other countries, how they have behaved in the past and then advise on best practice? Or do you do modelling based on potential epidemics and pandemics? How does your research take place? And maybe you might take us through the science of it.
Okay. So the phase two project was based on the findings of phase one. So in that first 18-month project where WHO was a member of the consortium, we identified data management as a key weakness of pandemic preparedness and response. So different countries had different capacities in terms of hospital preparedness or in terms of their laboratory capacity. But what was really lacking was an information system that linked all those factors together. So this 10 million euro project, which started in February, is building on all of the IT infrastructure that's been developed across Europe to build a prototype for Europe to respond to the next pandemic. So we have 19 partner agencies across Europe, some of the strongest public health agencies in Europe, Germany, the Netherlands, Sweden, for example. And what we're doing is looking at all of the lessons that have been learned in terms of the design of IT systems. What has worked best? How do we link mortality data with morbidity data from hospitals, with contact tracing data, with information from social media? How do we collect data on the vaccine rollout? What are the key variables that a country needs, a public health agency needs to have access to make decisions? And one very interesting initiative, WHO, on the 1st of September, launched what they call a WHO hub for pandemic and epidemic intelligence. Now, this is an initiative spearheaded by Chancellor Merkel. The German government are providing 100 million euro to look at data management for Europe. And the purpose of this is to have better data for better analytics, for better decisions. And our project very nicely dovetails into this. And we are in a very fortunate position in that we designed this project well before COVID-19. And even in our phase, in our proposal, we actually had a scenario of a laboratory leak of coronavirus that caused a global pandemic. And this was written 6 months before the actual event itself. So it was somewhat eerie.
So you essentially predicted the pandemic in a way before it happened?
Well, part of my work in WHO would have been to do a risk assessment as to what was out there and what were the viruses that were most likely to cause the next pandemic. And top of that list was influenza, and remains influenza as a novel strain. But second was coronavirus related to SARS-1. So obviously we didn't know timeline. We had no idea what we were facing, but it was it's a very opportune time to be doing research in this area because of the investment of countries across Europe in IT systems. And obviously tied to the IT system is also, we are looking at human resources. What is needed? What are the benchmarks for human resources in each member state? How many public health doctors are needed? How many contact tracers? How many laboratory experts? How many clinicians with expertise in ventilators? How many nurses who have background and ability to manage patients on ventilators? So we're setting European benchmarks for the staffing levels that are required to deal with a pandemic of a certain severity. And we also have a very important component of the project on modelling. And part of my work with the Department of Health is on the Irish Epidemiological Modelling Advisory Group, which is led by Professor Philip Nolan of Maynooth University. And we're a group of about 25 computer scientists, public health physicians, mathematical modellers. And this input has been very important in guiding the national response to COVID-19. So as part of my research project, we are along with Professor Jim Duggan, who is working in the School of Engineering. We are working on models that could be used by member states for a future pandemic. So we're looking at a model for disease X, for example, disease X with a certain case fatality rate, a certain case attack rate, a certain admission rate to hospital, and then a certain admission rate to ICU. And we're looking at countries can then assess how prepared they are, because without data, you really don't know where you are. Without information, you don't know how prepared you are. So this project, we are now 6 months into it. It's a really exciting time to be working on pandemic preparedness. We have the ears of you know, people across many sectors, the financial sector, people within, you know, within the defense sector. The most important thing is to ensure that the visibility and the sense of threat that we have now, that we don't lose that, and all of the investment that's been made in the last 18 months, that is retained in some format for a future pandemic.
What have we learned at Moira about how pandemics spread and how to prevent the next outbreak?
We've learned a few things. We've learned the importance of communication. We've learned the importance of trust. We've learned how important it is to have real-time information that is accurate and rapidly providing that information to the public, with the caveats that this information is changing and is evolving. And I think countries in Europe have done a phenomenal job to maintain that public support. We've seen New Zealand, for example, is one country where it's been described as it is a small country like our country in terms of 5 million people. International reviews have shown that countries of a certain size tend to get a lot more trust and buy-in from the population, particularly when difficult public health measures are being implemented. So I think that's one very important lesson. And I think we've seen, you know, a huge, I guess it's a commitment in this country to the welfare of others, whether it's older relatives. So I think there's been a really concerted commitment across this country to control this pandemic. The second area, I guess, is to look at the importance of public health medicine, to look at population health, to look at how our healthcare systems need to be addressing not just individual patient care, but population health in its widest sense. And tied to that is the importance of animal health and planetary health, which are much broader concepts, but we cannot exist. We don't exist in isolation. You know, we're a human population that are very vulnerable to the threats and risks around us. So I think we have a better understanding of the threat that the biological world poses to humans. We're more aware of the risk of wet markets, of unregulated selling and buying of wild animals in countries where they're at high risk of emerging diseases. And we're, I think, also aware of the risk of laboratory research being done where biosecurity measures are not at very high standards. So I think we've learned a lot of lessons. I think we've also realized we're a global family. You know, it's not just theoretical. We cannot run our world on the basis of a nation state. We are at risk of what happens in neighboring countries and countries across the world. Again, this is a message that from WHO's perspective, we've been putting out for years. And I think I think one good example is the whole area of vaccination rollout, that even if we've done phenomenally well in this country in terms of our vaccination uptake rates compared to other countries, but that will only be successful if we can ensure other countries around the world can achieve high vaccination uptake rates. So I think that's another lesson learned. We've learned that we are truly global, and that a risk that's posed to a person in Brazil is equally a risk to someone in Europe.
Some of these viruses, as we know, have been as a result of so-called spillover events where animals have transferred the viruses to humans in places like Asia. But how much of that is a risk compared to allowing something like the Delta variant to run amok in our communities and perhaps evolve or mutate into a more dangerous version of COVID-19 that we see already?
Okay, yeah, that's a very good question. And I guess what we have achieved in terms of the vaccine technology and the developments, particularly in the mRNA vaccine area, has been phenomenal. So we have a good handle on coronavirus SARS-CoV-2. Now, it will continue to evolve and continue to mutate. What we have in our arsenal now is a platform for SARS-CoV-2 vaccine. And what will be required are booster doses, which will take into account the evolution and the mutation in the genetic sequence of the virus. So it's not that we're not done and dusted, but in terms of mortality and morbidity, we are coming, you know, we're coming towards the end of this pandemic as a global event of major crisis proportions. We will continue to see deaths and cases in countries with low vaccination rate. So that is why it's so important that the management of the vaccination rollout, the management of vaccines, for example, that are coming towards the end of their shelf life, there are issues like that that need to be looked at, because we do have to put, this disease will remain endemic. It would be very difficult to eliminate it now. Talking to a former colleague in WHO, we could have, if we had the Wuhan wild virus, that was potentially possible to put that back in its box. But with the Delta variant and the Mu variant, with the increased levels of transmissibility, with the extensive transmission globally, it is most likely to remain endemic. So the reality is we have to be looking into other places for the next risk. And that next risk is most likely influenza. And there's nothing to say that it won't be of a similar strain to the 1918 influenza pandemic, which caused a lot of deaths in young, healthy males. And that was a factor of that particular virus. It was quite virulent. But at the same time, we're also looking in the animal world for other diseases. There are a number of diseases that we know about. There's Lassa fever, dengue, Nipah virus, Hendra virus. These are diseases that are jumping from animals into humans on and off, but most of them do not have efficient human-to-human transmission. So what's really needed is a global hotspot surveillance of animals to make sure if there's outbreaks in animals and animals are sick, that the public health departments in that country are rapidly notified and that information is passed to WHO in Geneva. So they're the kind of concrete steps that we can do to try and minimize the risk of a new pandemic. And I think within that, there is a reassuring message that what we have learned in the last 18 months will help us to deal with the next pandemic, which could potentially have a higher mortality rate. And it's also been said that we will look back and be grateful for the lessons the coronavirus told us, despite the economic and social and health impact of it over the past 18 months.
God, to think that that COVID-19 might be effectively a close shave for humanity is a depressing thought. As someone who's very interested in the communication of science, I know your first pandem project looked at this. How crucial is it to be able to communicate the importance of getting a vaccine or public health measures? And how difficult is it to come up with recommendations on a global level when cultural differences lead to wildly variable results, right?
It's a very important component of pandemic response. And, you know, historically, we may have focused on the scientific side of it, looking at the diagnostics, looking at the medical countermeasures, but none of this works unless the population is behind the response and involved in the response and trust the decision makers and the policy makers. And we looked at what are the factors that build trust and how is that trust maintained? And if trust is lost, how is that rebuilt? Or research showed that the key issue is for trusted public voices to be honest and to be upfront in their communications with the public and to acknowledge when something is unknown or unsure. And if something changes, to give a clear reason for that adjustment in policy. I mean, face masks is one example where there was initial reluctance and WHO was not recommending widespread use. And the policy globally was gradually changed on that. So we've seen many policy decisions over the past 18 months where, because of the evolution of science and knowledge on this virus, our interventions had to change. And we had to keep the public on board in a way. And there are a number of specific approaches that have been shown to work very well. Two-way communications, for example. Monitoring social media for how the public are accepting new interventions. And I think we've done very well in this country, I think, and across Europe. But again, it's a very country-specific approach. And one of the recommendations from a research project is that each public health agency, national public health agency, should have a communications team with expertise and experience in managing crisis. And we've looked at the aviation sector to see what can be learned from the aviation sector and how they manage a crisis event and how can we incorporate that into public health. And we're very lucky in a way when we put together phase one, we were making up, you know, pandemics, making up countries and social media chatter that would ensue from a major health crisis. We now have an incredible wealth of information that we can analyze and say, this worked, this didn't work, this might have happened earlier. And I think one key message is that in an emergency response, and it doesn't matter whether it's a flood or an earthquake or a pandemic, it's like landing a plane on the Hudson. You need your information at your fingertips. You need it in real time and you need it rapidly. And that's within the public health system. We need to ensure, and we have built that capacity over the last 18 months with a really great investment in visual analytics. So we're managing to take the epidemiological data and present it in a way that the public can interpret it and analyze it and understand it. And that again is another legacy of this response that will help us for the future.
Moira, I wanted to finish off asking you a little bit about your future priorities for helping the world cope with these sort of pandemics.
Well, I suppose the first priority will be to complete the Pandem 2 research project to put Europe on a stronger footing in terms of data management and how countries can work together. Countries will maintain their own IT systems that they've developed during the pandemic, but what we will produce is a shared platform that countries can share information, share information on resources, be it ventilators or PPE stockpiles, laboratory capacity. So that's one key part of the work over the future. The second is to try and, we've seen unprecedented collaboration between the biopharmaceutical industry, between academia and between governments, and work on diagnostic assays, on vaccine development, on drug development. I'd like to see Europe becoming more involved in international work with WHO on drug development and looking at what pathogens are out there and what can we develop in terms of therapeutics and diagnostics. So to have almost a stockpile in reserve that we can adapt in the event of a new pathogen emerging. And I think the third area is to, we've seen how important public health medicine and population health is. And it ties into the broader issue of planetary health and One Health, which is an initiative which ties human health, animal health, and environmental health. And I'd like to see in universities and medical schools across the world embrace this concept of the physician, the scientist, the researcher looking at planetary health and how we realize that we are not in isolation here. We cannot just look after our own health as our own species, as we can't just look after our own health as a nation state. So we need to be much more broad and encompassing in how we focus our research priorities over the coming years.
Well, it's been absolutely fascinating speaking with you, and such an exotic, in a way, research career you've had. Thank you so much for your time joining us on Leading Voices, Professor Maura Connolly.
Thank you, Jonathan. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for joining us on Leading Voices. If you would like to get more podcasts like this, you can do so wherever you got these. I'll see you next time.